It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The watchdog group Human Rights Watch says in a new report that Colombia and Panama, they failed to protect hundreds of thousands of migrants and asylum seekers crossing a treacherous jungle on their journey to the United States. We learn about the dangers of the Darien Gap and why Human Rights Watch predicts this passage could become more heavily traveled this year. Call in with a question. You can share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah McKinnon is a professor of rhetoric, politics, and culture at UW-Madison with expertise in U.S.-Mexico foreign policy and immigration. Sarah, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
The Darien Gap, we've heard it described as this dense jungle, roadless jungle. Why is this area becoming a focus of immigration policy debate in the U.S.?
The primary reason is that it's increasingly become the only path that individuals have as they're seeking pathways for residence, for movement and residence, that increasingly individuals, especially in the Western Hemisphere, in the Americas, have to travel this pathway because other options are just not available. There aren't options to apply for a visa and move in a regular way. And so this form of irregular transit is just increasingly just the only option that individuals have.
And last year, more than 520,000 people moved through the region, and those are numbers collected from the Panamanian government. What is causing this recent surge in crossings?
So I would say it's not necessarily a recent surge. For the last 3 years, every year, there's an increase in the amount of individuals crossing through the Darien Gap. I think it's helpful to look at the foreign policy collaborations that create the landscape of law and policy that make it just challenging for individuals to have other options. So, for example, in 2021, from pressure from the United States, Mexico implemented visa restrictions for Venezuelan individuals. So that meant that if you were from Venezuela, you could no longer just fly to Mexico with your passport. You needed a travel visa, a tourist visa. And of course, that's really challenging in contexts where perhaps there are no embassies to apply for a visa. And also, the visas take a long time and many people are denied. And so post 2021, we saw a really significant increase in Venezuelan individuals who were using the Darien Gap to cross through Mexico to hopefully, I think for many, apply for asylum in the United States. And so those sorts of policy implications then play out in the lives of individuals. We can see this also with the Los Angeles Agreement in 2022, which was another collaboration between states of the region. And those policies, while in some ways opened pathways for regular migration, also made irregular migration more and more challenging and forced many individuals through the Darien Gap region.
And that's what I wonder, Sarah, like how much cross-border collaboration is there between the U.S. And Colombia and Panama specifically to curb this migration through the Darien Gap? These countries know what is going on here. Is there any type of effective cooperation at hand?
Yeah, there is. And the cooperation is, I think, really innovative in a lot of ways. So last year in 2023, we saw President Biden working in collaboration with many governments of the region to implement what are called safe mobility offices. So at these offices, individuals can apply for refugee resettlement. They can apply for humanitarian parole visas, family reunification visas. There's a number of options for regular pathways. The offices are available right now in Colombia, Ecuador, and Guatemala, and Costa Rica. So I believe there are four countries right now. And it's been a year, so it's hard to see, a significant shift. But this is a way in which we can see governments working together to try to find safer ways for individuals to move and to seek residence in safe places. And yet, those pathways are not available to everyone. So, for example, in Colombia, the safe mobility offices are available for Venezuelan nationals, Cuban nationals, and Haitian nationals. And what we know about movement through the Darien Gap is that it's actually quite a global phenomenon. There are individuals from Asian countries and African countries who make passage through that area, and they are not eligible in Colombia to wait and apply for those programs. And so while there is really fantastic coordination, it's really in some ways a drop in the bucket of the movement through that region of the world.
We're discussing immigration and the movement through the Darien Gap specifically with UW Madison Professor Sarah McKinnon. You can join in questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jeff in Delafield is here. Jeff, hi, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. It sounds like a lot of these immigrants or migrants, whatever, are coming from the country of Venezuela. What are we doing to equip them to maybe change their situation in Venezuela to make things better there? My understanding is that Venezuela is an elected government where they, in theory, should have a chance to change things for the better. And, you know, I thought it was a government of the people, kind of a socialistic utopian type of government, but why is that not working?
Jeff, thank you for that question. Sarah, what about these root causes?
Jeff, that's a really fantastic question, and I think you're providing an answer in the question itself, which is to really focus on creating a reason for individuals to stay. The reality for Venezuelans right now is that it's really not possible to remain in country, but that doesn't mean it can't be the case in the future. And so really thinking about strengthening democratic processes, strengthening the context of security in a country like Venezuela, I think could go a really long way to addressing the flow of individuals, the movement of individuals that we're seeing. I mean, it is the case that currently 7 million Venezuelans live outside of the country, 3 million, almost 3 million in Colombia alone. And Colombia has done really fantastic things to provide the capacity for Venezuelans to remain there. But if the context where one is living, is not safe, if there are dynamics of insecurity that make that hard to remain there, of course we're going to see further movement. That's just one of the dynamics that's present with human migration flows.
You recently wrote in the conversation that the entire route through the Darien Gap is controlled by criminal organizations that make millions of dollars guiding people, smuggling people. Why are these groups allowed to thrive?
I mean, the Darien Gap, I think it's really important to keep in mind what that area is like. It's a dense jungle. And so there are no roads through the Darien Gap, this 60-mile stretch that crosses both Colombia and Panama. And so that makes it really hard to regulate the activity of criminal organizations. If there's no infrastructure for like security folks, for even humanitarian organizations to be present in that space, it makes it really challenging also to maintain people's safety. And the reports recently are really alarming. The individuals that I spoke with and the reports that I see from humanitarian organizations demonstrate there are alarming amounts of sexual assault, mass sexual assault that is happening as people move through that area. People are robbed pretty constantly. And also the landscape and the fact of being in a jungle also makes that stretch really, really dangerous. At least that part, I mean, I think it's really challenging to think about what would control, what would regulation of that space even look like in that context. The Panama has implemented what they're talking about as controlled flow, which is basically when individuals arrive at they're basically like camps or stopping grounds on the other side of the really dense forest. The Panamanian government is then putting individuals on buses, and then they move to the next northern border. And so, yeah, that dynamic, I think it's really challenging to think about how you would make it, how would you make it less dangerous when, the context is so inhospitable.
Sarah McKinnon with us, UW-Madison professor, researches immigration and refugee issues, gender violence as well, as we discuss the complexities of the Darien Gap migration route from Colombia to Panama in hopes of reaching the United States. Call in with the question. You can share your perspective at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the humanitarian crisis unfolding in the Darien Gap as migrants and asylum seekers cross a jungle's challenging terrain in hopes of making it to the U.S. southern border. UW-Madison professor Sarah McKinnon is with us, interviewed some of these migrants, shares her experiences. Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. You can add your views at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah, can you talk about the people who have journeyed through the Darien Gap and what you learned from their experiences?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that always stands out as I speak with individuals about their experience of moving through that jungle area is just, I mean, just how many aspects of danger there really are. I mean, it is the criminal organizations that control the area. It is the mud and the mountains and the days and days of walking and carrying children or carrying one's belongings. It's the lack of cell phone service as people enter the dense forest. And so that always really stands out in the conversations. I also think it's important to recognize that many individuals that ultimately might make this journey, this pathway through the jungle, ultimately perhaps didn't really think that they would first do that. Maybe they tried to seek residence in Colombia first. Maybe they tried to find a residence in another country. And so for many individuals that I speak with, it's really clear that movement is necessary because of the climate in one's home country. And so they leave searching for a safer place. And if it's not safe in the next country, they keep on moving, right? And so that dynamic, I think, is really important. For many individuals, it's not necessarily the goal to come to the United States or Canada, but that increasingly becomes the idea as the only option that potentially could be safe and feel comfortable.
In terms of safety, does the remoteness of the Darien Gap make female migrants especially vulnerable to violence, to exploitation, other risks when crossing this area?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. In December of 2023, the Doctors Without Borders reported that one person was sexually assaulted every 3.5 hours while crossing the Darien Gap. And recently, the Panamanian government did not renew the contract with Doctors Without Borders, who were basically the only humanitarian organization working in that area. And that, I think, is really significant. It means that individuals who are moving through the jungle do not have access to even basic medical care. And it also means that the women and children and even men who experience sexual assault are not getting attention for that either. It's a really dire situation.
And you study gendered dynamics of migration. So this area must be, you know, very significant to that piece of your research.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, we know from decades of research that sexual assault is used as a form of power and control and even torture and genocide. Those phenomenon, I think, are absolutely well documented. And I would say that the same phenomenon is happening in this context.
It also makes me wonder, as you think about people trying to get to the southern border, but I also wonder, is it possible for migrants to find a safer place to live and not have to cross the Darien Gap or multiple countries just to get to the United States?
Yeah, and that is, I mean, we see those programs available. So the program that I mentioned, where Venezuelans can remain in Colombia and seek permanent resident, get work permits, that's a really important program to think about. We can also see it in Mexico. Mexico has been a receiver country for a number of nationals, a number of communities. It's important to look at the logistics of who it qualifies. So, for example, in Colombia, if you're Venezuelan, there are opportunities, but if you are from Cameroon, for example, or from Afghanistan, there may be less opportunities to stay. And so, I think we really need to think about how to take seriously the global nature of migration through the Americas, because for many of those individuals, the only option is to keep moving. The only option is to really continue in this really irregular, dangerous path.
I also wonder how militarized are the borders in these various countries, whether it is different from country to country.
It is different from country to country, and for many of the countries through Central America, the idea is to keep moving them forward. And so that's where things like the Panamanian government putting people on buses to then move them to Costa Rica as quickly as possible. That's one of those dynamics. And you see that through many of the countries in Central America. Once they arrive in Mexico, the context is a little different. So many individuals will arrive in the area of Chiapas, the state of Chiapas. Tapachula is the city that where many individuals arrive. And at that point, people can apply for refugee status in Mexico, but they need to remain, as I understand it, in the state where they're applying for that. And so that means that there's a lot of concentration of people who were in movement, but now are remaining in Tapachula and that or in Chiapas, and that then creates other dynamics of insecurity and just problems with violence. And that's true throughout the context of Mexico.
And even a competition to like find a job or get established or
Absolutely.
find social service. I mean, all of that would be completely taxed if you have such a condensed area.
Absolutely. And that I would say is true in many of the countries where there are programs to remain or programs to seek permanent residence. The other dynamic is that there just are not stable jobs. So individuals may find, kind of a job here and there that maybe pays them for a week or pays them for a month, and then they don't have a job after that. And they're not well-paying enough to create a home somewhere. And so the dynamic of having access to work enough that is stable, work enough that pays enough to make a home is also really significant when we look at new receiver countries like Colombia or Mexico. That dynamic, I think, is also a factor that we need to think about as something that could be addressed through policy. It could be addressed through programs.
And in our final moments together, Sarah, are there any particular policies that could drastically curb migration through the Darien or even possibly bring it to an end?
I mean, I think the dynamic of the safe mobility offices that I mentioned is really significant and innovative, and more could be done. The idea with that is that individuals go through the processing, either for refugee resettlement or for the other visa programs, in a country like Colombia or Costa Rica, and they wait there until they have the visa, and then that allows them to go to the United States, or Canada actually is another one of the receiver countries, or Spain actually. So I think augmenting that program could be really significant, and especially thinking about countries, nationals other than just Venezuela and Haiti and Cuba as applicable for those programs.
Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Sarah McKinnon is a professor of rhetoric, politics, and culture at UW-Madison. Research involves immigration and refugee issues and gender-based violence. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks to a listener request, we learn about the latest treatment advancements for the rare disease called amyloidosis, in which the body's cells function abnormally. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about high school students learning about journalism through a video game.
We live in a time when fake news permeates social media feeds and partisan coverage blasts through some cable news channels. Teaching media literacy can help people wade through the disinformation and become critical news consumers. As Christina Leffering tells us, a video game created by UW-Madison's Field Day Labs aims to teach students to become more media literate.
This is the sound of a room full of newbie reporters having a very rough day.
I was fired for assaulting a crane.
Why'd you do that?
Spray it with pepper spray or run.
Why would you get fired for that?
Because I had to go to court or something because it was very illegal.
To be clear, Marshfield High School student Angel O'Brien Weber was not fired, and no cranes were assaulted. She and her classmates are playing Headlines and High Water, a computer game where they guide Elle Benjamin through her day as a rookie reporter at the fictional Twin Lakes Gazette. The city has flooded on the day of the Cherry Festival, and Elle has a limited amount of time to report and turn in stories about the flood. Similar to Choose Your Own Adventure, students like Jesus Mireles decide whether she helps her neighbor catch her loose chickens.
I lured him with food. That's pretty smart, by the way.
Absolutely.
Where to go and who to talk to. In Sarah Sharma's case, she got stuck on the phone with the town busybody, Fred.
Time my stupid cats for 45 minutes.
The goal is for students to turn in stories.
Your story isn't going so well.
Stupid Fred.
Hopefully good stories, on time to her boss. Sarah Gagnon from Field Day Labs, the Madison-based company that created Headlines in High Water, says initially the journalists were given budgets.
All the journalists that we talked to, like, immediately reacted, and they're like, we don't have money. Like, right. We have time. That our currency is time.
Early decisions in the game affect outcomes later on. If Elle eats breakfast, she has more endurance. If she socializes, her interactions with people later on are more fruitful.
You need to have endurance. If you have to stay up really late, or you have to have tech skills, or you have to be able to earn people's trust.
Lindsay Whiting learned at least one valuable trick of the trade.
Food is the way to their hearts. If you bring them food, they'll tell you stuff.
But all students at some point run out of time.
Actually, one thing that has been really funny during all the testing with the kids is that it makes them so angry when people won't talk to them because they don't have enough trust. Or they feel like it's very unfair when they run out of time. And I'm like, oh, I'm sure journalists feel that way too.
They also have to find the right balance between facts, anecdotes that add color, and pictures. Joe Nyman turned in a breaking news story that was all photos and is now working on an article on wetlands.
I don't think my entirely picture article would have flown for the science one because that one required more factual evidence, which makes sense. Mm-hmm. Because if it's a science article, it should not just be pictures.
The bigger goal is to get young people to think about news and its quality beyond whether it's real or fake.
news isn't like perfect or fake. It's always going to be critiquable and something that we have to be questioning and engaging with.
Joe Nyman came away thinking about credibility and the quality of information.
Sometimes you have to fact check what other people say. So if someone says something and you're not quite sure about it, you have to go and check other people just to make sure that it's a good quality quote.
And hopefully it'll get some students to think about maybe becoming a journalist one day.
I don't like this
job. There's any chickens in here.
I'm quitting.
But not Jesus.
I'm going back to farming. I don't like this job. I hate it.
Even if these students end up being farmers, teachers, or anything other than a journalist, hopefully they come away from this game understanding and appreciating the work journalists do. To not only get the story, but get the story right.
Christina Leffering brought us that story on the media literacy video game, Headlines and High Water. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum. We discuss complexities now in treating the rare disease amyloidosis. The National Institutes of Health cites there are roughly 2,000 new cases per year of the primary type called AL amyloidosis. Thanks to Jeff and Madison, who suggested we talk about it.
My wife was diagnosed in March of 2008. Typically, back then, people would live maybe a year and a half, something like that.
Jeff shared that their wife lived nearly 14 years and credits the hematology treatments. Call in with the question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Anita D'Souza is a hematologist and medical oncologist with Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin Cancer Network and an associate professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. D'Souza, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So can you walk us through, as a physician who works so closely on this disease, what it would be like for a new patient who is, you know, who is a newcomer, who does not realize what amyloidosis is?
Yeah, it's a rare disease. As you mentioned, only a few thousand individuals are diagnosed each year with this disease. So being as rare as it is, physicians sometimes don't think of it when they're seeing patients that amyloidosis is on the differential diagnosis. And what that means for people having this disease is they keep getting new signs and symptoms of the disease. They keep seeking help from the healthcare profession. They see multiple specialists, subspecialists, and it takes several months to sometimes years before that unified diagnosis of amyloidosis is made. And so what that means is at the time of diagnosis, oftentimes people have very advanced disease. They're quite sick. And that makes it even challenging to get them started on treatments because our current treatments are varying forms of chemotherapies and immunotherapies.
Which makes us think with chemotherapy that this would be, which is used in cancer treatments. But, you know, this isn't a type of cancer, is it?
So that's a very interesting question, and sometimes it just boils down to semantics. The underlying disease for light chain or AL amyloidosis, it starts in the bone marrow as a clonal disorder. And so one form of this clonal disorder is the blood cancer called as multiple myeloma, which is a bona fide blood cancer treated with chemotherapy, stem cell transplants, and so on. But in amyloidosis, that clone is very small, typically, and it doesn't have all the features of a cancer. But still, the best way to control that clone is by using treatments that are FDA approved in multiple myeloma. Now we have a regimen that is also approved in AL amyloidosis, but it is a form of chemoimmunotherapy.
You just mentioned, I think, a couple different types of the disease, AL amyloidosis, perhaps one of the primary one. Can you talk a little bit about these different types and what distinguishes them?
Yes, so amyloidosis actually is a term for a protein misfolding disorder or a group of disorders in which proteins misfold and turn into these amyloid fibrils, which has a very characteristic appearance under the microscope. And depending on what the primary protein that has misfolded is, there are many different subtypes of amyloidosis. And currently, we know there are 42 different proteins and peptides that can misfold and cause amyloidosis. And as you mentioned, the most common subtype currently in the United States is the AL or light chain subtype. But another one that is increasingly being recognized is transthyretin or ATTR amyloidosis. And there are two main forms of ATTR. One is a mutation in the transthyretin gene that leads to hereditary amyloidosis, and another one that occurs with aging and what we call as age-related transthyretin amyloidosis. And when we see a patient with amyloidosis in the clinic, it is very important to figure out accurately what subtype it is, because treatment for these subtypes really depends on what is the protein that is misfolding. So for example, we treat AL amyloidosis with chemotherapy, but transthyretin amyloidosis chemotherapy would have no effect on it.
Oh, wow. A biopsy then is involved in confirming amyloidosis. Can you explain like where the tissue sample comes from?
Yes. So when we suspect amyloidosis, doing a biopsy is needed to confirm it. Now, there is a clinical scenario with transthyretin amyloidosis where we have good imaging studies and other blood tests where we now don't need to do a biopsy, but for light chain amyloidosis, a biopsy is very essential. And we typically start with doing a bone marrow biopsy and a fat aspirate, which we take a small sample of fat from the abdominal wall. And typically between these two tests, the bone marrow and the fat, we are able to detect amyloidosis in about 90 to 95% of the time if it is present. But in those remaining 5 to 10% of the time where your biopsies could be negative, it is important not to give up on the diagnosis if the clinical suspicion is high, but to move quickly to doing the target organ biopsy. So for example, if it looks like the heart is involved with amyloidosis, we want to go on to get a heart biopsy. Or in other settings, if the kidney tissue is involved, we do a kidney biopsy.
I wonder, I mean, it's labeled, you often hear like labeled rare disease. Is that an accurate depiction? How common might a misdiagnosis be?
Yeah, so, you know, we have always thought of these diseases as rare, but as in the last, I would say, 3 to 5 years, with increasing awareness, with increasing and improving diagnostics, we are seeing more and more patients being diagnosed. And not just the AL subtype, but also ATTR. So it is certainly moving from being considered as an ultra rare disease to now being something we increasingly see in clinic.
Dr. Anita D'Souza with us, hematologist and medical oncologist with Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin Cancer Network, as we explore new treatments and symptoms for amyloidosis and efforts to raise awareness about this disease. Call in with a question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about diagnosing and managing amyloidosis and the latest research on this condition that manifests in different ways, disrupting the body's organs. And a shout out to Jeff and Madison for suggesting we shine a light on this disease. Let's hear from you. Call in with a question. You can share your views at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Anita D'Souza is a hematologist and medical oncologist at Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin Cancer Network. Dr. D'Souza, you volunteer some time to the amyloidosis support group. What advice do you participants in the group seek from you?
I think one of the things, challenges, is because it's a rare disease and there aren't too many physicians, healthcare providers who feel comfortable managing this disease. Patients, caregivers often feel unsupported. And so we recommend using some of these patient advocacy groups, and one of which that I volunteer my time in is the amyloidosis support groups, where we gather, we group in, there are chapters throughout the country, and we meet on a weekend where we spend like half a day talking about different questions that patients and caregivers have, talking about the disease, talking about advances on the horizon for treatment and new research that's happening. And patients and caregivers like it. I think then they go on to support other people in their local cities and towns. And what I hear from people is that the disease is not as rare as we think it to be. And everyone then tells me that, oh, now I know two other people with this disease, and mm-hmm. we thought this was super rare.
We heard from Mona Johnson, Executive Director of the International Society of Amyloidosis, which is headquartered in Madison, wrote in to say that researchers from around the world have been collaborating to improve diagnosis and treatment for decades. And Mona says this is an exciting time with new treatments available. And at the end of May, scientists will present the latest research at the 19th Symposium on Amyloidosis to be held at Mayo Clinic. And that is May 26th through the 30th in Rochester, Minnesota. Mona also giving a shout out to amyloidosissupport.org. What are your thoughts there on the latest interventions and where the science is going on this disease?
Yeah, I think we need more research to just understand this disease better. Why does it happen in some people? We know that a lot of people have this clonal plasma cell disorder. As we get older, certain proportion of us just develop it, but not everyone gets amyloidosis. So why in some individuals these proteins misfold? And after they misfold, we will see a very heterogeneous manifestation. Some people have just their heart get involved, whereas others will have many different organs involved with amyloidosis. So there's still a lot we need to understand about just the disease pathophysiology. But then after that, we're still looking to make our treatments better. While we now have many chemotherapy options to treat the underlying clonal disorder, we don't have drugs that work that can remove these amyloid fibrils from organs. But there are a couple that are currently in clinical trials that we need to quickly finish those trials, understand if these drugs work, and if they work, we need to get these approved through the Food and Drug Administration so they can be accessible to patients with this disease. So research at all these fronts, the basic science, translational research, and then finally clinical research.
What types of side effects might someone expect from their treatment and from their treatment journey with you?
So because our current clinical treatments are focused on controlling the clone, which are forms of chemotherapy, the side effects we can see are related to these drugs. So some of our therapies can cause more fluid retention. So amyloid patients already have fluid retention from heart involvement or kidney involvement. And sometimes these drugs can make these effects worse. So a lot of times my patients feel worse when they start treatment in those first few months before they start feeling better. And so it's really important to provide very good and close multidisciplinary supportive care during those first difficult months to get over some of these toxicities of treatment, as well as just the effects of amyloidosis, the symptoms of amyloidosis. And it's only when we lower those precursors, proteins down, and we start seeing organs get better, it's then that patients start feeling better.
Dr. Anita D'Souza with us, Milwaukee-based hematologist, medical oncologist, as we talk about amyloidosis and treatments of this disease. Call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234. Dr. D'Souza, in terms of the hereditary aspect, the medical technology CRISPR can edit genes to help treat certain illnesses, diseases. Could CRISPR gene editing technologies be effective for people with this genetic condition?
Yes, there is actually a study that was just recently published within the last year or so. And there is a clinical trial that is ongoing using this technology. So there is a lot of hope and a lot of excitement. Certainly not as relevant for the AL subtype, but could be something of value in other subtypes of amyloidosis.
Is the medical community coming any closer to a possible cure?
So the current way we understand and think of AL amyloidosis, we see this as a disease of aging. As we get older, some of us develop a plasma cell clonal disorder. But how do we make these proteins not misfold? I think that protein misfolding is something that can occur with aging. So yes, there are aspects of this disease that are related to aging, but we are far from understanding this fully, and how do we then use this knowledge to result in treatments?
In our last moments here together, is there an aspect that you're looking forward to in your own research in amyloidosis?
So as I'd mentioned earlier, patients tell us that they have had symptoms for many months to years. Mm-hmm. And when we investigate this their journey through the healthcare system, what we recognize is that they are seeking help, they are going to different doctors and specialists, but it still takes a long time to get to that diagnosis. And what we are trying to understand is this journey through the healthcare system, where we are using health records, medical records, to understand what are the different diagnoses these people are being diagnosed with, and can we develop clinical algorithms that could help predict that a given person, based on the different manifestations that they are having, could have amyloidosis. So maybe we can include triggers in the healthcare record that this patient could potentially have amyloidosis, consider doing a biopsy or consider referring to hematology. So we are hoping that using these tools, developing these tools, could help move that timeline to diagnosis months to even years earlier.
Yes, harnessing big data there to lead to a more efficient diagnosis. Dr. D'Souza, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too. Dr. Anita D'Souza, hematologist and medical oncologist at Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin Cancer Network. And for disclosure, Froedtert and Medical College of Wisconsin is a business sponsor of WPR. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. That is pianist Jorge Federico Osorio playing from Manuel Ponce's Piano Concerto No. 1, Romántico. Osorio will play the concerto with the Madison Symphony Orchestra and Chorus in their season finale, which is a Cinco de Mayo celebration of Mexican composers and musicians. As we explore classical music concerts, call in with a question. You can share comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lori Skelton is here, Wisconsin Public Radio's host for the weekday program Afternoon Classics. Lori also hosts and produces WPR's weekly broadcast of Wisconsin Classical. Lori, welcome back.
It is so good to be here. We've got great things to talk about.
We have got some you've just put together such a fantastic amount.
I didn't put it together. Trust me, the state put this together.
Okay. So here we are. April through May is when orchestras put on these season finales. What do you look for in a season finale performance?
It should be a celebration. Mm. Now, for some, that means the big, rare works that don't get performed often. You've had an entire season to work on it, to practice, to get it ready. For some, that means all the favorites. Let's get everybody out and enjoy all the things we know we love. Ultimately, for me, for any ensemble, you've been working together now, say, 8-9 months. I think a season finale should be about showing off, showing what you've accomplished in this last year of artistic growth, of working better together with your colleagues. Hmm. This should show you at your best, whatever you do.
Oh, that's really interesting. Also, some symphonies have been putting like masterworks in their title for their season. You know, what types of certain qualities or characteristics that you would expect from masterworks?
That's a really good question, because I think everyone will answer it a little bit differently.
Okay. Yeah.
I will say this. For a lot of people, a masterwork is something that has stood the test of time. Mm. For many people, that means a composer like Beethoven. And Beethoven is showing up an awful lot in the next couple of months.
Mahler is trending.
Mahler is trending, in part because of the film Maestro.
Ah, okay.
And that incredible performance of the Mahler second that was included in the film. So Mahler is somebody we look to, especially because Leonard Bernstein kind of brought Mahler out of obscurity in the middle of the 20th century. Mahler's works are big. Often involving a chorus or a vocalist. So again, you're bringing all your forces together for a concert like that.
Let's zoom in here on the calendar and listen to some music. The Madison Symphony Orchestra features this Cinco de Mayo celebration, 3 concerts, the 3rd through the 5th. It's a Grammy-winning group, Mariachi Los Camperos, playing their rendition of Cuando Yo Quiera Has de Volver. Let's listen.
Cuando yo quieras devolver, no serás tú quien lo decida. Cuando la gana a mí me dé, tú volverás cuando yo diga. Porque aunque trates de olvidar, nunca
lo What are you looking for out of this concert series and this tribute?
A great deal of emotion and a great deal of virtuosity. For anyone who thinks classical music is only European composers, well, yes, Europeans came to Latin America in the 1600s, and classical music took hold, but the best classical music out of Latin America takes into account indigenous dances and songs and ceremonial music. And what we're going to see for that concert, again, world-class pianist performing a work from a Mexican composer from 1912, just before he started using more indigenous material. Mm-hmm. So here was a composer, Manuel Ponce, had just come back from studying in Europe, brought to Mexico. Okay, this is what I've learned. And in the subsequent decades, he went further and further. Mm-hmm. So we have one aspect of Mexican classical in that piano concerto, and we have another mariachi bands have incredibly virtuosic guitars. Mm. Those trumpet lines are not easy, and there will be violins as well. So the combination gives you this incredible span of what Mexican classical music is. It's incredibly exciting.
We are talking about all the excitement and the synergy, the energy of the spring music concert season with Lori Skelton, host of WPR's Afternoon Classics. You can join in along the way. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Moving now to the La Crosse Symphony Orchestra, playing both Vivaldi's The Four Seasons and Astor Piazzolla's The Four Seasons of Buenos Aires. Let's hear La Serenissima, playing part of The Four Seasons by Vivaldi. So the concert is titled Tango Meets Vivaldi. What can we expect there on this collision course?
Believe it or not, it's not such a collision. Vivaldi wrote The Four Seasons. It was one of the very first pieces of instrumental music to have extra musical connotations. He actually wrote sonnets to say, this is what my music is about. And you hear, as you just heard, the birds, the insects getting very agitated before a storm in the summer. Now, in the 1960s, Astor Piazzolla was developing what we now call Nuevo Tango. You can't necessarily dance to it, just like you can't really dance to a Strauss waltz. they're concert dances. But he wrote these four separate pieces that he would occasionally play together. In the 1990s, a Russian composer rearranged the Piazzolla pieces for violin and string orchestra, and he actually inserted quotes from the Vivaldi pieces into them. But he took into account Vivaldi was writing in Italy, Piazzolla, Buenos Aires. We've got a hemisphere difference. So what he did was he'd sneak, say, a quote from Vivaldi's Winter into the Astor Piazzolla summer season in Buenos Aires.
I'm mixing it up a bit.
And now I've attended concerts where the ensemble has played both of them. They'll usually alternate, one Vivaldi, one Piazzolla. It's amazing. Aww. You'd think, how can these two pieces possibly work? They're both high energy. They both really demand a lot from your string players. Again, highly virtuosic works. It's a great night at a concert.
And the La Crosse Symphony is celebrating its 125th anniversary and has a world premiere of Madrigal Divine, composer Nathaniel Dett. And so what do you make of an orchestra then with performing this work?
Our Nathaniel Dett is an African-American composer who is getting more and more attention. But unfortunately, not everything he wrote is for a big ensemble. What La Crosse is doing is they're taking one of his piano miniatures and orchestrating it, giving the orchestra a chance to show you what this composer is about.
Wow.
So this is exactly what an orchestra at 125 years should be doing. You talk about masterworks, and yes, that's a bedrock for so many for classical music. But classical music has been around for centuries because it is an evolving form. And for an orchestra to say, all right, we need a new voice, we need to give this voice a new setting, and we will carry that forward, it's a wonderful thing to do.
And I want to give a shout out to the Dean of Northwestern's Music School, Jonathan Bailey Holland, who is taking that work taking that work forward. Is that it?
I believe so. It would be lovely to see other miniatures from our Nathaniel Dett orchestrated in the same way. So maybe some other orchestras around the state can pick that up.
Lori Skelton is host of WPR's weekday classical music program, Afternoon Classics. This is Astor Piazzolla's Primavera Porteña from the Four Seasons of Buenos Aires. The La Crosse Symphony will be playing this Piazzolla's and Vivaldi's versions of the Four Seasons on June 1st. Call in, share your insights on classical, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. That is jazz pianist and composer James P. Johnson, the pioneer of Harlem stride piano, and here performing Fats Waller's Honeysuckle Rose. Lori Skelton, our guide to the spring classical music lineup with concerts slated for all corners of Wisconsin. We're getting a taste of them. Lori is host of Afternoon Classics on WPR. Call in with a question. You can be part of the conversation at 800-642-1234. Okay, so we're headed to Brookfield now, where Aaron Deal is performing his Stride and Ragtime program honoring pioneers of early African-American jazz. What is slated here?
Aaron Deal has been the artistic partner for the Milwaukee Symphony for three seasons now. This Stride and Ragtime program is just him at the piano. He's been performing this around the country, I think around the world even, for over 4 years now. He was doing it a lot on stream, even during the pandemic. What you have is a program that starts off with the early pioneers, and Aaron Deal is also a composer, so he brings us forward through the 20th century, showing how these are the roots of what is being developed now. And you may think you know from stride piano, you may think you know from ragtime. We've all got our favorites in that genre. He's going to take it even further. He's really going to give you a great grounding, and that means an appreciation for what you will hear in the future.
Well, let's hear Aaron Deal playing Prologue from his 2013 album, Bespoke Man's Narrative. So, Lori, what can you tell us about stride in this East Coast style of piano playing?
In its basic form, stride piano is where your right hand is playing the melody, and the left hand is playing one low note and then a chord over an octave higher. Your hand is striding or leaping on the keyboard. It's very effective if you don't have a rhythm section, because your left hand basically becomes the bass and the drums. And it's the basis for a lot of incredible music. Again, the idea that this is another form that evolves. Jazz is not static, and here we are going to get the basics and move it forward. We've got 88 keys on a piano, and you sometimes speak in a metaphorical sense of the piano can be an orchestra. I think what you're going to come away with from this concert is, yes, the piano can be an orchestra, and an orchestra for jazz as well.
And it's interesting, too, because Aaron Deal kind of melds, he crosses jazz and classical influences. So what he might do to James P. Johnson's works could be pretty interesting.
And it's what he's going to do to your ears that is, I think, the most interesting. Even if you think you know what jazz is, I think you're going to be surprised. And if you don't know what jazz is, this is going to be a great way to find out.
Oh, so now we are traveling to April 13th, which is Saturday. Clara Schumann's A minor concerto performed by a Ukrainian-American pianist in Anna Shelest?
I believe Shelest.
Anna Shelest. Performing with the Duluth Superior Symphony. And so can you talk a little bit about what she is bringing to this performance?
Clara Schumann is someone who has been getting a great deal more attention since the 1970s, but we're still catching up on a lot of what she did, in part because she was kind of written off as, oh, she's just a piano prodigy. Yeah, she was only having concert tours around Europe when she was a teenager. Well, she was having concert tours around Europe throughout her life. She was an incredible teacher. She changed the way we listen to piano recitals. She said, let's get away from some of the virtuosic stuff and start playing smaller, more subtler pieces that really show off the musicality rather than the theatrical, the fireworks in a pianist. All this while she was married, to a composer, somewhat volatile composer, while she was writing her own music and having 8 kids.
Mm.
This was an incredibly talented woman who needs more attention. Clara Schumann's piano concerto is being played more and more often. Her piano sonata, which she wrote when she was 22, was not performed during her lifetime. It wasn't published until the 1990s. So we've got some catching up to do.
A lot of catching up. And I was kind of scrolling through Anna Schella's performances. She seems to gravitate to Schumann and has been doing a number of performances leading up to this moment.
This is, and so why not have this person come and show what this concerto really can do? Again, this was one of those things that Clara wrote when she was a teenager, hoping to have an opportunity to keep performing it herself. Now we've got new generations of women taking it on.
I love to hear that. Spring Music Concerts here with Laurie Skelton, our guide, host of WPR's Afternoon Classics. You can join in on this journey. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts on classical concerts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So tomorrow night, Milwaukee's Present Music will feature the Blue Hour in full with one of the composers, Shara Nova, singing with a small string orchestra. So let's hear Nova singing My Dear from the Blue Hour song cycle in the section written by Sarah Kirkland Snyder.
My dear, I think yes. My father crossed the field and stood. My hair a cold flag of rain, my hands coated with tomb dust, my mother's hand broken by a fierce wind.
Oh, I could just go on listening. So this is The Blue Hour, written by 5 women composers and sung here by one of the composers. What are you expecting?
Remember when I said a season finale should be a big celebration? Well, first of all, this is not the season finale for Present Music. They've got another concert coming up this season. This is the flip side of intense emotional experience when it's very, very internal. This is a 75-minute song cycle. 5 women composers working with one expansive poem, Carolyn Forché's On Earth. This is a path of a woman's life journey. It's in English, so anyone who says, oh, I'm uncomfortable listening to songs where I don't understand the language, you can definitely understand what you're hearing. Shara Nova is not someone I knew before I heard what Present Music was doing. And as you can tell, this is a voice that defies description. This is a voice that gets in your soul quickly and stays there. What am I expecting? I won't be able to attend the concert in person, but Present Music is hanging on to the option of a streaming concert online. I will be sitting with my headphones on, and I don't think you're going to be able to talk to me for probably an hour after the concert ends. It's going to be that intense. It's going to be amazing.
And I appreciate that this is a collaborative effort, a unified work.
Right.
That to me is really notable here.
And it's genre bending. It was on the top of NPR's top 10 lists across genres all last year, and it's only being performed twice in the world this year. Once in Milwaukee and once in Paris. So this is something you do not want to miss.
Laurie Skelton, host of WPR's Afternoon Classics, our guide to classical concerts around our state. Call in questions, share your perspectives, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Thank you. Needs no introduction. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. That is the London Symphony Orchestra performing The Imperial March by John Williams from Star Wars. It's a hint of what's to come for several symphony lineups, and you can be part of this conversation about spring classical performances. Give a shout out to your local symphony. The number to call in with a question, share thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Laurie Skelton is here, host of Afternoon Classics, the weekday classical music program on WPR. So, Laurie, by the numbers, this spring, movie soundtrack music by John Williams will be performed by four symphony orchestra, and then there are high schools, two concerts from high schools. There's Kenosha's Reuther Central there on May 4th, Bigfoot High School, Walworth, May 18th. So what are in some of these lineups?
Obviously, Star Wars. Yeah. All the big, exciting Raiders of the Lost Ark and Jurassic Park and
Jurassic
Harry Potter.
Park.
And
okay.
It's... With John Williams' 90th birthday fairly recently, obviously we wanted to celebrate him. I think it's a good reminder, though, movie soundtracks are meant to be emotional. Obviously the big themes that stick with you.
Mm-hmm.
But when we talk about underscoring in a film, this is powerful music that you may not be aware always you're listening to. You may not be aware that it is influencing what you're seeing. It can often give you the inner life of a character when nothing is being verbalized.
Mm.
So if you're thinking, oh, come on, John Williams, isn't that just a little too easy, a little too obvious? Don't sell movie music short. When you have a chance to really focus on what's going on under the pictures on screen, I think you're going to be surprised at how good it can be.
Well, music having a language to itself as well and really carrying that plot forward. It makes me wonder, though, like, how do the musicians feel about playing, like, E.T. and Jurassic Park and Star Wars? I sometimes wonder what they're thinking about John Williams and those compositions.
I will be honest. I've lost count of the number of musicians who have told me, kids are running up to me after a concert, sometimes days after a concert, if they see me with my instrument case and they suddenly connect, oh, you played the big music on the stage with the film. The response from younger people making that connection between the acoustic instrument and the big cinematic experience, it's powerful. And I say that as someone who heard her first Wagner arias when Bugs Bunny was singing them. So we make jokes, yes. Don't sell it short. There is a reason it works.
Yeah, there's a gateway here to introduce young people to the music.
Absolutely. Yeah. The Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra in late June, they're going to be doing another live film score, and it's going to be Toy Story. I mean, you got a friend in me. You got a friend in your symphony orchestra. Give him some love.
You got to save that line. You got to use that line. I mean, that's genius.
Oh.
Okay, so we're going to move on here to Requiem.
From the sublime to the scary.
Okay, right. I didn't say that we'd have segues here. So, Verdi's Requiem. This is the Chicago Symphony Orchestra playing Dies Irae from Requiem. Okay, and so Maestro John Demain conducting this piece with the Madison Symphony Orchestra April 12th to the 14th. That's very soon, by the way. What can you tell us here?
This is a Requiem Mass. Verdi was moved to write it in 1874 because someone he admired, a philosopher, a writer, Alessandro Manzoni, had died. He wanted to write something in tribute. But this is Verdi. The grandest of grand operas. As you heard, this is not something that can be performed in a church. This is not something that's going to have a liturgical setting. This is a 90-minute opera. You have a very demanding set of pieces for the chorus to sing. As you just heard, you're going to destroy your percussion section before the performance is out. You have four operatic soloists who are asked to sing so many different kinds of solos. You get the full range of character that you expect from certain operatic voices. I saw a Facebook post from one of the recording engineers who's working at Overture and mentioning the Dies Irae. He said, that's kind of metal, isn't it, 150 years ago. It is scary, especially when you get to the end, the Libera me, deliver me, Lord, from hellfire. And it's done as a means of getting the chorus to sing in fugue, so you've got the chorus over and over, like all the voices in the world, deliver me, deliver me, deliver me. At times, the soprano is shouting, demanding salvation, but it ends very, very quietly. Suddenly, you realize just how human and how tiny you are. Libera me, libera me. It is a 90-minute opera on the subject of your own mortality. It's an amazing thing to sing. It's an amazing thing to witness. I'm not going to make any comments about it's just a few days after the eclipse. I'll leave you to put that together. But it's always, this is a masterwork. And because it requires so much of an orchestra in its chorus, it's not done that often.
How does an orchestra prepare for it, rehearse it, put all of these moving parts together?
Orchestras, in general, even if it's not the concert this coming weekend, they will usually have the music beforehand. And I hear this from so many people. You never show up to rehearsal to learn your part. You show up to rehearsal to learn what your part does with everything else together. So if you're a smart musician, you get the music ahead of time, you learn your part, and then you show up. And again, you've been working with your colleagues now all season. You know how to work together. You know how to help one another. That's what the final week of rehearsals does. How does a chorus prepare for this? Chorus has been working on this in some form all season. I can guarantee you that. Because this is a marathon. You do not just show up and try to run it. You train for this.
Lori Skelton, host of WPR's Afternoon Classics, taking us on a tour of spring classical music concerts. And you can join in, be part of the conversation, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Lori, let's shine a light on John Demain in September, announcing he'll step down as music director of the Madison Symphony at the end of the 2025-2026 season. And I understand that also is a huge anniversary for the symphony, 100 years.
Yes. John Demain celebrating his 30th anniversary this year, symphony coming up to 100 years. Goodbyes are never easy. And I imagine everyone is approaching these milestones with a great deal of emotion, incredible pride in what has been accomplished, incredible trepidation, thinking, oh no, we're going to have to start over again with somebody else. I know everybody is, let's just say everybody is taking care of one another. And it will be very difficult for a lot of people to say goodbye. I think the idea, though, that John Demain is giving us, shall we say, advance notice, there will be guest conductors coming in. It's crazy not to think they might be thinking maybe they might be the next music director. So this gives an orchestra a chance to work with different conductors. It gives different conductors a chance to get to know the orchestra, get to know Overture Hall, get to learn how their conducting style works in that space. It's a very odd job interview.
Relationship building here.
Yes. before you've even got the job, you sort of have to get the job. It's going to be a little nervous and scary, but it's also going to be a very exciting couple of years as the symphony starts thinking about where can we go next.
Well, we'll be watching and listening. The Eau Claire Chamber Orchestra and the Chippewa Valley Festival Choir will perform Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, Ode to Joy, May 11th, Pablo Center in Eau Claire. And let's hear Ode to Joy performed by the Berlin Philharmonic.
Freude!
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 So, Lori, what comes up for you?
Aside from all the times I've sung this,
all the flashbacks.
What comes up for me is what can grow out of something relatively simple. That tune, the Ode to Joy tune, isn't complex at all. Leonard Bernstein once called it beer hall music. I mean, it's a tune that anybody can sing, even after you've downed a few. You still know where you are with that melody. But what grows out of it, of course, the intense energy of the singers behind those beautiful words by Schiller, the idea that we are meant to care for one another and we are meant to be joyful together, that mankind is a brotherhood, sisterhood, if you will, and that there is a great deal of wonderful that can be built out of something relatively simple.
Mm, and I think the audience probably is also very much a part of that as well.
Absolutely. This is something you show up knowing you're going to be refreshed emotionally, spiritually, if you will. There's a reason that Joyful shows up in Sister Act 2. It's the same tune. Somebody gave it new words in 1907, and they gave it a modern twist for that movie. That tune carries. It carries us all to a better place.
WPR classical music host Lori Skelton touring us to amazing places around the spring concert season in Wisconsin. This is virtuoso violinist Gilles Appop playing part of the first movement in Beethoven's D major violin concerto. Appop, a guest soloist with the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra this month. Call in with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the New York Philharmonic playing Movement 4 in Gustav Mahler's Titan. Lori Skelton, host of WPR's weekday classical music program, Afternoon Classics, highlighting spring classical performances around the state. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lori, you gave us a taste earlier of Gustav Mahler's popularity popping up here in Symphony No. 1 in D major. Titan will be played by Fox Valley Symphony on the 27th of this month and Sheboygan Symphony on May 18th. So what is making Titan a popular choice?
Mahler is a wonderful thing to end a season with. It's big, it's bold, it asks everything and more from your orchestra. Mm. However, a lot of Mahler's symphonies are over an hour in length, And as I say, a lot of them need your chorus, you need vocalists. Not everybody wants to devote that much time to one composer for their season finale. The first symphony, which Mahler kind of put together from a bunch of earlier works, comes in about an hour. So you've got time to play other pieces, but still give you that grand symphonic experience to close your season. What is fun for audiences is that there's a tune we recognize as Frère Jacques, Are You Sleeping? Are You Sleeping? Now, it was also sung in Mahler's Boyhood, but it's sung in a minor key in Austria. And he uses that tune in the minor key in one of the movements. So it's always a tease for the audience thinking, oh, I know this. Oh, wait a minute. I don't know this. So there's a follow-up for a composer named Evan Williams. He used to work at Lawrence University. He's written a short piece called Titan that uses some of those themes from the Mahler Symphony as a way to say, okay, audiences, you think you got fooled by the Mahler. Let me show you what happens when we take those tunes and we put them into the 21st century.
So some playful elements there.
I believe one of the words he uses to describe it is groove.
Okay.
So it's taking, again, the idea that you've got a familiar tune, a folk tune, a fairy tale tune, and it goes how many different places when you give it to a symphony orchestra? It's an amazing way to find out.
Now do this, now do that.
Yes.
Now try this. How about here? And we just keep following around as the audience, just going from one place to the next, and who knows where it takes us.
As the orchestra tosses the tune back and forth, that's part of the fun of an orchestra. That's why you have different instruments and different combinations. They do so many different things.
Well, you are taking us now to the Duluth Superior Symphony opens its May 4th season finale concert with a fanfare for the Uncommon Woman and closes with Carl Orff's Carmina Burana in the house. And so that is going to be awesome. But let's listen to London Symphony Orchestra playing In Taberna Quando Sumos from Carmina Burana. I'm ping-ponging there and also thinking of a figure skater, and doing a spin very fast.
Classical music can offer us some of the peak experiences of being human. Classical music can also take us to a tavern and say, everybody drink up, which is exactly beebeat. You hear the number of beebeats, that's just Latin for drink. Everybody drinks. We go from Leonard Bernstein calling Beethoven beer hall music to Carmina Burana has a scene in the tavern.
Oh, I love that. Well, take us to Concerts on the Square. And this is so beloved in Madison and starting June 26th. And there's going to be a Grammy-nominated Latin band, Tiempo Libre.
They've been here before.
Been here before.
Audience favorites.
Yeah. So what to expect from this season?
Six concerts outdoors, and there's an opportunity to hear a variety, again, bringing different things to a classical chamber orchestra. One concert I'm really looking forward to is the July 10th concert, when one of the final forte performers is going to be doing the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto. Jane Story will be performing with the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra. They're ending the season on July 31st. Talk about a crowd pleaser. John Novacek is going to be the soloist for the Rhapsody in Blue.
Oh, wow. And all outdoors, a beautiful scene mm-hmm. around the Capitol. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Just make certain that you bring a low chair when you set down your picnic blanket. You do not want to be blocking anyone's view. Concerts on the Square is... I mean, it's been 40 years for Concerts on the Square. It's also the 25th anniversary season for Maestro Andrew Sewell. So again, lots to celebrate. Mm. And a great place to bring your kids if they've never heard classical music before. Let them run around on the grass while they're listening to the string section.
Oh, I love it. Well, let's land here on news from WPR later in May, expanding locally hosted classical music 7 days a week. There's also jazz, world, folk music on each weekend. What are the possibilities here? Because Wisconsin Classical on Sundays is also expanding to a two-hour program.
We're going to go from noon until 2. And as you just heard, some weeks we've got so many concerts to talk about.
Yeah.
I don't have enough time in an hour to actually highlight more of the music. It will be wonderful to have more Wisconsin performances on the weekend. I'm hoping that we have more time to spend with the entire state, getting more concerts recorded, getting more artists interviewed, having a chance for Wisconsin to hear Wisconsin is what I'm really hoping for our Sunday afternoons.
Aww.
We've had a great start with the recordings we do have. I just want to make it bigger.
I love it. Lori, thank you for stopping by. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Lori Skelton, WPR's host of Afternoon Classics and also hosts Wisconsin Classical. This is London Symphony Orchestra performing O Fortuna from Carmina Burana. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.